home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. This is Rob Watson, your host of Rated LGBT Radio, a Garrett Miller platform production. And we have some really important stories for you tonight. We actually are focusing on two different stories. They really have nothing to do with each other, except that they're both happening now. They're both centered around some dysfunction, but it's dysfunction in different ways. The first story is a follow-up of the one that we've been following and people are very interested in, which is the trans military ban and what is happening there. Article or a memo was apparently leaked to the Wall Street Journal seemed to have specifics about directions that were going to be given to the Pentagon by the White House. However, that memo seems to have sort of disappeared or not been really distributed, or not the final memo actually coming out at all. So it's gone into this sort of vapor status. But we have two seasoned journalists on who will tell us what was presumably in that memo, what it means, what the next steps are, and where that memo actually may have ended up. So dysfunction in government is going to be part of the first story. Then the second story is around the situation that's happening in St. Louis. There is a lot of tension going on in that city with the activism there and the racial tension, the systematic racism within the police department, and all of that is converging into one very hot mess. And we're going to try to unravel that and tell the story of a transgender woman who was killed by the police. However, the transgender woman had allegedly stabbed her neighbor and stabbed pretty severely one of the police officers before being killed. And then the reaction to that and where that all went. In the discussion of that story underlies some really key points that I think we want to look at tonight, which is looking at our own activism and where things can get too far, whether there's some perspective on the part of some activists that needs to be reexamined, and perspective of activism over time. So let's go back to the first story, though, the transgender ban. My guests tonight are two of the most well-known expert experienced quality journalists you're ever going to want to find, Brody Levesque and Karen Ockham of Karen of the LA Blade, both super, super seasoned and accolades all over the place. So I want to bring them on together and we'll get some of these stories told. Good evening, Brody, and good evening, Karen. Thank you for joining.
How are you doing? Sure.
Hey, Rob,
I'm doing good. It's kind of a mess out there in the world. Brody, do you want to take us into the transgender ban and what's happening there?
Well, Karen actually has done the latest reporting on that, so I'm going to go ahead and defer to her because she just did an update for the LA Blade here about not even 45 minutes ago, and she's got the most latest status on what we do know. In terms of what's going on, I'll just simply note that those of us in the Washington press corps are kind of trying to figure out what's going on because there's so much, you know, swirling around this. And the press secretary, Sarah Huckabee, today essentially told the gaggle in the briefing room that when the White House had an announcement, they'd let us know. So I'll throw this to Karen.
Which is kind of what they say about everything, it seems to me. You know, one of the interesting points to dovetail on what Brody was just saying is one of the reasons that there's such confusion and consternation among journalists, not just those in the Beltway, is the fact that, you know, if you think about it, the Muslim ban was discussed, talked about on the campaign trail, on and on and on. Finally, there was an announcement, the Muslim ban. And there was documentation, there was a memo, people had that in hand shortly thereafter. And the problem here has been that there's been a lot of, the only thing that people know for sure are the tweets. And General Mattis sent out a memo to senior staff, he's a defense secretary, talking about ethics and the importance of treating everybody fairly and with dignity. So that's something that one could, you know, actually have in hand. But all this discussion about the transgender military service ban has been talk. We haven't been able to get our hands on literally what this new policy is. Now, yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported that it was, in fact, a 2.5-page memo. I've been reporting, thanks to some great sources to whom I'm very grateful, for accurate information. It started out as a complete ban, and then they rejiggered it into a modified draft proposal, a draft policy proposal that tended to focus a lot on the medical aspect of it. And then all of a sudden, you know, that was kind of held in abeyance. And, I mean, given what's happening in the world, given what the Secretary of Defense has had to deal with, not just the threats from North Korea and Trump in North Korea, and China telling the U.S. to stand down on North Korea, et cetera, but all the four major serious incidents with the Navy where people have died. So there's all of this that he's had to deal with. So, it was kind of suspected that policy was going to get stuck, you know, put a pin in it in the White House while he's, dealing with all these other things, until the Wall Street Journal story came out yesterday. That is a separate story from the source I've been working with. So that, to me, verifies, because all of the details that I've been reporting, the Wall Street Journal also has reported with certain phraseology that I did not have. But otherwise, our two stories parallel and are very similar. So I do believe that such a document, 2.5-page memo, exists. Now, the latest thing I understand from a White House source is that has been sent back to the White House counsel's office for, quote, adjustments, after a number of legitimate organizations had a reaction and came out with public statements in reaction to the news in the Wall Street Journal. So they were going to, sort of tweak it theoretically, probably, in order to avoid lawsuits. Good luck with that.
So, Karen, when you say it got sent back, where had it gotten to, do you believe, for it to then be sent back? Was it in the hands of the president and it got sent back? Was it in the hands of the Pentagon?
No, not the president. I don't think the president would. I mean, the president would have to sign off on it at some point, but he's already signed off via tweet. But it has to go through the White House counsel for vetting. So we don't know whether it's still in the White House counsel's office, if it's out of the White House counsel's office and sitting on you know, some senior deputy's desk waiting to be sent to the Pentagon. But that's the other piece of it. Something that a policy that has this significant a change has to go directly into the hands of the Secretary of Defense, and he's out of the country. So,
but it didn't get to him, you don't believe, but when in the sent back boomerang did not arrive to him at that point, it got sent back before reaching him.
It's still in the White House, never did get to Mattis, and as I said, he's out of the country. Now,
right.
The hitch to all of that is that we've seen that this administration really doesn't understand protocol. So they may just, you know, email it to him and think that suffices. You know, Lord knows. So it's all sort of still up in the air. I don't know if it's still in the White House counsel's office or whether it, you know, the latest version has been signed off on and is now ready to go. But I do know that the Pentagon has not received it. And yesterday, the Washington Blade's Chris Johnson did ask a Pentagon spokesperson if he had received it, if the Pentagon had received it, and they said no. And until then, you know, he said that they would be, you know, giving a briefing when they received it. And additionally that, you know, meanwhile, they're treating all service members with dignity and respect, you know, kind of trying to tell active duty service people, chill out. Don't worry. Nothing's happening yet. And even when it gets to them, they have to review it. And this is the new part of the whole thing, not just the deployability, which is a phrase that is new to me, you know, that I have seen regarding this memo. But it apparently is giving Mattis a six-month deadline to review and formulate and implement the new policy. Now, the White House press secretary was asked about that today, as Brody alluded to, and she essentially dodged the question. But part of the question was, does the defense secretary have any leeway in implementation? And that, my source has not talked to me about any sort of discretion that the Secretary of Defense might have, except in the possibility of how you define deployability. If
yeah,
you
that's
can
what I was
shoot
gonna
straight
ask, because,
and kill, you're deployable.
Right, because the deployability seems to me like a complete and total out for the Secretary of Defense, in that, you know, to your point, the statements made have basically been everybody who is transgender that we know of in our and that we don't know of who are transgender, we don't know, are, you know, almost by definition deployable because there have been no incidents. So sort of by
well,
that
yes,
formation.
And the military makes allowances if somebody has cancer, if somebody's pregnant, if you need a transition reassignment surgery, you make those medical arrangements as former Army out. Former Army Secretary Eric Fanning has been saying all day, you know, the military accepts you and deploys you based on if you can meet the requirements. And if you have a medical necessity or, you know, some health issue that you need to deal with, everybody tries to do it around deployment dates. So, yeah, that, you know, as you put it, that may be an out for Mattis. Because he's already said, kind of like what Barry Goldwater said, if you can shoot straight, I don't care if you're gay, if you can shoot straight,
right.
You know, regarding don't ask, don't tell. So that may be, the out.
And I want to go
but
back
we
to
we don't know.
First, yeah. I want to go back to one of the first points you made and ask about that. You know, you made the observation, and this observation has been made of the president in different scenarios where he reacts one way and the experience is one follows one process. Then another situation comes up and the process is completely different. In many cases, much more dysfunctional and out there. Those seem to map to both his personality and his the situation of whether the event was something that he has been mantraing about throughout the campaign trail. It's been part of his stable of things that he stands for, or whether it's something that comes up and he applies his whimsy to, for lack of a better term. And the whimsy situations are the most bizarre and are the most terrifying, because he is so off the wall and out of his league in terms of whether what he came up with was right or wrong. He is so undecisive and clueless, for lack of a better term, that it almost seems like he is unable to lead the country. I mean, is that
well,
where
yeah,
we're...
I'd push back on the word whimsy, actually, because whimsy is such a fun word. It's such an esprit de corps, you know, it's a joie de vivre, you know, it's like, let's have whimsy. No, this guy is like, as Clapper has said, you know, questioning whether he is fit to govern.
That's a point that I wanted to make. I also wanted to interject, you know, there's an important distinction here. And that is, during the first part of his presidency, particularly with some of the debacles that were occurring, for example, over the Muslim ban and some of the other things, the White House Chief of Staff, the special advisor, Steve Bannon, and numerous others had split the White House into factions. And they were all vying for the president's attention. They were all vying for whatever issues that they were playing home team for. There was a complete disconnect. And the other part of it was is that no one really was guiding the president. Now that Secretary Kelly has taken over as White House Chief of Staff, although we're still seeing some indiscriminate, for lack of a better term, behavior in terms of Twitter and a disconnect from the speeches that he's been given, you know, I'm being told by my White House sources that the staff is slowly but surely getting whipped into a singular focus. Now, the big question is whether or not General Kelly will be able to do that with the president. Now, there's been a couple of instances where we think that that has been the case, and then the next day, it all changed. I'll give you an example. We saw his speech about the situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan and India. He was focused. The very next day, he's in Phoenix, Arizona, and he's off the rail. So, you know, that's the dynamics of this White House. The ability to govern, I really do believe, is highly questionable. I really do. Kelly notwithstanding. But that does make a big difference here, is the fact that we do have someone sitting in the office of the White House Chief of Staff who is eminently qualified to be in that position based on his experience as a Marine general, as a theater commander, and, of course, as the Secretary of Homeland Security, even if it was set for such a brief period of time.
Right. And I want to go back to the defense of the word whimsy for a second, because here's what I meant by that. The Trump decision-making process seemed to be on this, that Mike Pence came to him with a very specific initiative that they were trying to enact through Congress. They failed twice in terms of limiting health care expenditures for transphobic individuals in the military with their transphobia. But what the whimsy button that I'm talking about that seemed to get hit in Trump was that, you know, if we're going to solve something, let's wave our magic solving wand and go to extremes, and we're really going to do it, and let's just not have them there at all. And, you know, kind of goes into, and why I'm saying whimsy, because it goes completely beyond logic and completely beyond the real world. and into this Trump what imagination type thing. And he seems to do it. He did it again when he reacted to Charlotte, where we were all watching white supremacists, you know, and their rally and everything they were doing. And Trump fantasized that, you know, this was about Confederate statues and, you know, some part of history that was, I mean, it was like this complete disconnect from reality.
Well,
so,
but
anyway.
It's not disconnected from his reality. And here's the thing, mm-hmm. and this also goes back to what Brody was saying earlier. I really think that there is a shadow government going on here, and that is led by Mike Pence. Now, you know, I think that the chief of staff, General Kelly, is doing the best he can, but he still answers to the vice president as well. He is not above the vice president. So I think that when Mike Pence has this whole, you know, Mike Pence is the head, if you will, at least the titular head, of Trump's evangelical base. And Trump knows that that he has to please those people. You remember him talking about how he doesn't ask for forgiveness and he has this tiny little wafer and this little thing. And I mean, how the evangelicals can support him, I don't know, except that it's a purely political thing. They want Gorsuch because they want to overturn same-sex marriage and they want to overturn abortion. They want another Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. They also want religious liberty. They want, they want, they want. They were very disappointed by the promised religious freedom initiative that he touted and then signed, and nothing's come of it. Actually, it was brought up in the briefing today. So they're not necessarily pleased nor taken with Trump's whimsy. So Pence is there saying, look, your base is annoyed. You made promises to them. This is something that will help smooth things over until we can get this handled. And that's what this is. The transgender ban is all about politics, because remember, that's what the anti-LGBT groups are raising money off of. That's their big issue these days after they lost marriage equality or same-sex marriage debate. Now it's all about transgender. So you go to the heart of it where you think you can get more than just conservative people. Oh, surely red-blooded Americans will understand this. You know, so it's all politics, and Pence is leading a shadow government there. And he is telling Trump, you made these promises. You have to keep these promises to your base. We're the ones that got you elected. Do this. And that's how the tweet started. That's probably how this latest thing happened after the two failures in the legislature with Duncan Hunter and, you know, these people coming up, getting to Pence and Tony Perkins and all that. So we have to be mindful of that, because whether Trump is impeached or whether there's the 25th Amendment or he resigns or whatever the case may be, we've got Mike Pence, who's ready to step in, and he is the real Darth Vader here.
Right.
You know, he's the real scary one, because he knows how government works, remember? And he is an evangelical Catholic who quasi believes in, you know, in theocracy.
With him at the head. I totally agree with you, and I think it's interesting because Mike Pence was called home before they made the Afghanistan announcement, and seemingly under normal circumstances, a vice president might be called home to be informed of that. And in this case, mm-hmm. it might have been to get approval. So,
Well, I think it was more about Bannon and, you know, and the Korea games going ahead. And, you know, he had to be prepared for that. You know, I mean, you have to be brought up to speed in case there is a nuclear war. You know, because
right.
you've got North Korea, you know, Kim Jong-un is not the, you know, he's pretty fickle as well. So you've got these two man boys with their fingers on the nuclear button here.
There is some other problems that tell us that General Kelly doesn't have a complete handle on that West Wing. That's the lack of a presidential response now actually twice to the tragedies that the Navy has incurred with
yes.
both the Fitzgerald and the McCain. You know, we now have, I think, what, 23 dead and missing American sailors.
Mm-hmm.
The president has not made any real effort to get on top of that. There's been no, in the latest incident with the McCain, we haven't even, you know, the first reaction coming off the helicopter when he was told was, that's too bad, which is not exactly a very presidential response. And needless, that's not something you want to hear from the commander-in-chief.
Right.
Coupled with the fact that we haven't heard anything else from him, I agree with Karen. I think that, you know, there's a lot of the dynamics here involved, and the fact that they're still pushing this thing, even though you've got a military establishment that honestly does not want it, they don't want to deal with it. It has no bottom line effect on any of the things that the Christian Wright have been complaining about. And as Secretary Fanning said in his interview this afternoon with MSNBC, you know, it's just to keep skewing numbers. I mean, the RAND study said that, you know, the cost for transitional surgeries and other things, you know, we're looking at probably $2.4 to $8 million tops, whereas the White was saying, oh, it's going to cost billions of dollars. I mean, these incredible sums of money that are just beyond the scope of reality. And Pence is sitting there the whole time riding that train with it. The thing that's also got to be taken into consideration is you've got a major criminal investigation and a national security investigation hanging over this administration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the president. It is also the vice president. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I've said this to people that, you know, at the end of the day, it may still end up being, you know, a resignation, an indictment, and Speaker Paul Ryan putting his hand on the Bible. And the next thing is he's the president of the United States. That's not far-fetched. But you're still running into a greater difficulty here. And the greater difficulty is you still have a Republican establishment on Capitol Hill. Even as hard as this White House is slamming them, and he has definitely fired up. He's directly attacking the majority leader in the Senate. He said a few snide things about the speaker. Yeah, he's rapidly losing his congressional support. Yet at the same time, they are so desperate to get their agenda through and to get their little boxes ticked off on all of their little Christmas presents that they've wanted for years that they'll put up with this. And this is really becoming extremely problematic. And we're starting to see it now even with the transgender ban. So I'm looking at this going, at some point in probably the not too distant future, as Congress returns from its summer recess right after Labor Day, we heard the president, for all intents and purposes, threaten the government shutdown at his rally in Phoenix. He's been slamming congressional leadership. I think that the next stage of this is going to be a showdown, if you will, over the debt, over the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I think that we're probably going to end up seeing a cumulative total of events that will probably paralyze not only just the White House, but probably paralyze the Hill as well. And I think the American people are you know, getting to the point where they're even getting tired of it, although I will say Trump's base and the evangelicals seem to be unaffected by it. So that's just my take.
Well, until the government shutdown and Social Security checks stop coming.
Right.
Or are threatened to stop coming and Medicare stops being paid for and, you know, and Medicaid, you're going to see a whole lot of people, you know, look, he's promised, you know, millions for this opioid crisis. And, you know, what's happened with that? It's a blip on the screen. I mean, there's so many issues. But if there is a government shutdown, you know, those seniors in particular who vote and are already pretty riled up are going to question their cult leader.
Right.
You know, somebody's going to start asking the question, wait a second, what is in this Kool-Aid? This doesn't taste
right. There are two major things about to happen that if the Trump administration is not prepared, and they're not, and the decision-making goes to whatever we call it, the Trump fantasy, you know, knee-jerk stuff, which when he's not prepared is disastrous. But one is the government shutdown and the debt ceiling. The other one is we have a major hurricane that is about to hit the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is FEMA prepared? Is, you know, the answer is no. And, you know, what is going to happen when we are watching, you know, a weather-driven disaster, i.e., you know, look back up to climate change issues, and a responsiveness that from an administration that generally doesn't know how to respond to
Katrina 2.0.
Well, no, I think it'll be worse than Katrina. You know, at least with the Bush administration, we had a FEMA director in place, and we had a proactive White House. So it wasn't as though that we would be caught in a position where there would be still problems. But now, if we're looking at it in terms of the Trump administration, we have A, no FEMA director. We have an acting deputy in charge of Homeland Security. We have an administration that still hasn't figured out what the chain of command is and is full of infighting, even within the White House itself. We have a constricted flow of good information going to the president. We have a president who doesn't like to listen to details to begin with, including good intelligence and other things. So, you know, I find it, you know, we have a president of the United States who gets his information from Fox News, and then if there's something that pisses him off, he tweets about it 30 seconds later. Yeah, this is not a guy that knows anything at all about the functions or functionality of government. So I think that what's about to happen in Texas, you know, the governor of Texas just declared a state of emergency. He's cleared out 30 affected counties. Mm-hmm. They have already put hurricane emergency procedures into play along, I think it's almost 150 to 200 miles of coastline. The fourth largest city in the United States, Houston, is about ready to get slammed. So, you know, Rob's right. It's going to be, if this is a Category 3, like Katrina, it's going to be worse than catastrophic. This goes beyond what happened in 2005.
Well, let me ask you, Rick Perry is the Secretary of Energy. Can he jump up and down at the White House and say, wait a second, Texas is my bailiwick. We need to, you know, we need to do this, this, and this.
But Karen, Rick would have to figure out his own resume and the job he's supposed to be doing first, right?
Yeah, he would need to get his own job description in line.
Yeah, put on a new pair of glasses, huh?
Yeah.
And go from there.
So, well, guys, I want to switch us. I know we have mega shows we could do on all the issues we brought up. I want to take us to St. Louis, which is, you know, we're going to leave the Trump bubble and go into the activist bubble and the situation there. Brody, can you start us out with the story of what has been happening in St. Louis and get us up to speed on that situation?
There are two distinct events. The first event is that the Westboro Baptist Church will be protesting, as they've done over the last 3 or 4 years, at the Cardinals Pride Night at Cardinal Stadium. Now, this is something that Shirley and her little grandkids have been doing for a while, and, of course, it's Westboro. The younger queer activists and a lot of the activists in the area, of course, have this huge counter-protest that they want to do. The problem is that you have a lot of cooks and not enough dishwashers, waiters, and prep cooks. So what we have is we have a classic case of too many chiefs, not enough Indians, and nobody's agreeing on anything. And we're also seeing something in St. Louis that is a micronism of what we've been watching in the United States in the larger gay movement for the last decade. And we've been seeing it more and more in the last 3 years. And that is these radical young far-left queers that I'm not going to label them as anarchists because that wouldn't be fair. But they really are, they absolutely will not work with others nicely in the sandbox, particularly if they think that there's an affront there. And what happened with this protest against Westboro involved two different factions fighting over this protest, and there became literally a generational fight there too. And both sides started slinging mud at each other. Now, I had actually, what caught my eye was the fact that they had weaponized people using or wearing the pink pussy hats, which, as you know, were used in Washington during the inauguration as a protest against some of the more misogynistic inclinations of the chief executive, along with his past horrid behaviors. But the younger queer activists were screaming that that use of that hat was an affront to the trans community. It was insulting. It was a trigger. Some of the older
I'm sorry, how is that? I didn't get that.
Thank you. I mean, I know.
That was my reaction as well.
And this, unfortunately, though, but this started off one of the largest battles I've seen in my life, and then both sides basically drew their knives and they started going after each other. In the middle of all this, on Tuesday, a transgender person of color was killed in a confrontation with St. Louis police officers. Now, I'm going to give you the lay of the land here, okay? The St. Louis Police Department was responding to a call Tuesday morning early that there was a scuffle and that there was a victim of a stabbing, okay? So they were on their way to a neighborhood to effect an arrest, okay? What happened next is kind of what is the point of contention, particularly with the activist community. Police officers went to the stabbing victim's home first and then went next door to the residence of the person accused of the crime, okay? And it escalated to where the person accused of the crime severely cut an officer on the arm with a knife, and the police officers opened up and killed her. I'm sorry, I didn't want to misgender, but and I'm reading off a police report, and they misgendered. They said him. They were presented with what they thought was a young black male. It was actually a young black transgender female. But the way this was phrased to the police officers was completely different. Now, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch framed it this way. In court documents filed in St. Louis Circuit Court, police said that Kenny Kiwi Herring, who was killed in a confrontation with the department's officers, had accused a downstairs neighbor earlier that morning of starting a fire on the back deck of Herring's residence. Herring then stabbed that neighbor after Herring's partner, domestic partner, provided the kitchen knife. Herring was fatally shot by responding officers after Herring, in a scuffle with officers, cut an officer on the arm. The partner, Herring's partner, was then jailed on assault charges for handing the knife to Herring. The neighbor who was stabbed was hospitalized with stab wounds. That victim suffered a collapsed lung in the attack. Two officers who were involved in the shooting were on administrative leave. This is departmental protocol while the case is being reviewed. Now, from what my understanding is, okay, this has been an ongoing situation. The victim, who was a 30-year-old, was living with his girlfriend downstairs in a two-family flat. This is like a duplex. Herring, a transgender woman, lived upstairs with her partner and their three young sons. At some point Tuesday morning, much earlier, a fire broke out on the upper balcony of the flat. St. Louis Fire Rescue had determined the charcoal from a barbecue pit on that balcony had fallen out, caught fire, and then had caused damage to both the second and the first floor porches. At that point, Fire Rescue did notify the police department because at that point there was, you know, nothing to be suspicious about. However, according to what the police department is saying next, Herring apparently lost the plot, accused the other neighbor of being an arsonist, and it escalated. And, of course, the escalation got to the point where, you know, officers are arriving. They've got one victim bleeding from stab wounds. He's telling people to go after Herring. Herring was upstairs. They tried to effectively arrest, and that was the end of it, okay?
Right.
Shooting. Now, the background of this, St. Louis is right now a very volatile environment. This is the same place in St. Louis County outside of the city, as you know, where the Ferguson incident took place, and there's been a couple of other shootings. There is an extreme amount of distrust between the minority communities in both St. Louis City and St. Louis County to those police departments, and I mean extreme. And there are bad feelings on both sides. Last night, the situation was exasperated even further. The young activists held a protest in the area of St. Louis that is essentially its gayborhood, if you will. In the course of the protest, the protesters were in the middle of one of the major thoroughfares, and a gentleman in a black Mercedes-Benz started to lean on a horn, push protesters out of the side, literally with the car, low speed. There's video footage of it. But the protesters had beat on the car and a few other things, and it escalated, and then the car tore off through the crowd. A couple people, not seriously injured, were knocked out of the way by the vehicle. The driver of that car, by the way, has been charged with a series of felonies by the St. Louis Police Department. But again, it was all of what happened in Charlottesville, which, as you know, that's what killed Heather Fire. And, of course, when you have temperatures so high and running around. Now, I've spoken to various members of both factions, and I've spoken to a good friend of mine who's an editor for one of the local papers and magazines there in St. Louis, and I'm being told that it's a tinderbox and it's become ground zero. And one of the things that I thought would be good for us to discuss tonight is it's not just St. Louis. We are seeing this elsewhere. I really had wanted to get a couple of my friends who happen to be trans females and black, but unfortunately they were both engaged and couldn't make it onto the show tonight. Because this is a difficult thing, you know, to discuss, particularly because I, you know, and I'm very open about it. I'm a white guy. Yeah, I'm an old white gay guy. And so, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing. And this is the other part of the problem, too, is these young queer activists, particularly the queers of color, the QOCs as they call themselves, you know, they've got to the point with a lot of the elder gays and some of the other members of the gay movement, and they've just decided that, you know, it's white privilege, they don't know what they're doing, you know, they disrespect us, and a lot of this is going on in St. Louis right now. The vitriol, I mean, some of the Facebook posts, Rob and Karen, are just they're off the rail. And some of the things that are being said are just, they're horrible. And at the end of the day, I asked a couple of the activists, you know, not in relation to the trans situation, because that's that one's complex, okay, because it's a police-involved incident. And that one gets a lot. But going back to the Westboro thing, it's like, guys, Westboro Baptist Church has zero relevance in terms of do we need to even protest them. Consider this. There are people walking into Cardinal Stadium that should be protesting because they're writing checks to Vicky Hartzler's congressional campaign. If you're going to protest something, how about we protest the people that are going after the Southern Poverty Law Center, like, you know, the Grove Church Kennedy Ministries down in Florida filed suit today against SPLC. I think Matt Staver and Liberty Council have done it as well. These are people who are being designated hate groups. I mean, if we're going to protest something, how about we go after the people that really have a negative impact?
Brody, I want to jump in because we've got 14 minutes and you're like throwing like 3 days worth of topics. So I want to sort of simplify a little bit here. I do want to go back to the one issue where we have a situation, an activist situation around something that isn't cut and dried. It's not, you know, like a lot of the situations where an unarmed African-American is gunned down because of a systematic police, you know, bias. This is a situation where it's hard to say to a policeman, no, that was inappropriate when that policeman's life was actually potentially not just threatened, was actively being attacked. At what point should LGBT and, you know, people of color activism stop and say some situations are bad?
And that's really, I think, the fly in the ointment that I can't seem to get past some of the activist vitriol with that is, you know, they're so laser focused on here's another, you know, person of color and queer, well, trans in this case, a trans female, who's been murdered, and this is the term they use, murdered by a police officer. Okay. I don't like the term murdered because it I don't honestly truly believe that it was the intent nor the training of those St. Louis police officers to murder this young lady. I think it was their training that kicked in. And I think, and at the end of the day, it was a very human reaction to being, you know, grievously wounded and hurt. I mean, you know, a human being is no different than an animal, you know, that's wounded. They get mad and they'll fight back. And unfortunately, in this case, you know, fighting back included emptying your service revolver. So,
right.
You know, and I'm not justifying at all the circumstances, but I mean, the biggest problem that I have with these young queer activists is they're not getting context. You just laid the context out. This was not an unarmed black male or female, okay, who was wantonly shot by an armed police officer. This was a person who was armed with a knife, who attacked a police officer, inflicted damage that actually caused that officer to get hospitalized, and forced the officer and the officer's partner, okay, to fall back under their training. You know, there's a point where it's like, okay, maybe we need to have the discussion about, can we find another way of defusing the situation or using a taser instead of killing a person? But again, we have to have that conversation. And I'm not seeing these activists being willing. You know, I had three of them hang up on me. They don't want to talk about it. To them, it's murder.
Right,
you know?
Right. And here's my question for you and Karen and myself, because, you know, we've all been, you know, presumably around the proverbial block. But we all grew up in a generation where we took a lot of crap in our lives.
Yeah.
We took a lot of discrimination that today even a hint of would produce ire that we didn't produce. I mean, we took it. We hid who we were. You know, if somebody discriminated us on the job front, we just kind of ducked and ran because that was how we had to survive in the day. Now we and I'm as responsible as anybody, have trained a lot of these people over the last 10 years to not tolerate that kind of abuse, that kind of oppression, you know, and they've learned the lesson almost too well, where
Can I interject here?
Sure.
Okay, a couple of points. First of all, we've trained people from our experience in nonviolent civil disobedience, which is very different from trolling and being all hate and trying to top each other on who can be more hateful on the internet. So you shut somebody down that way and ruin somebody's reputation. This is a brand new world. Secondly, just historically, we've only recently gotten around to understanding that we're a people. All that suffering that we did as individuals, and we inculcated, the shame within us because our parents said this, the church said this, the community said this. So if I turn out to be this, it is my fault. Something's wrong with me. I need to try to change, whatever. It starts kind of more as an individual. It wasn't until, you know, Harry Hay, of course, started talking about us as a third sex, but it wasn't until Stonewall, really, that we started seeing ourselves as a people. Michael Callan used to say the gay community is a useful fiction. So, on the other hand, African Americans in particular that is one of the things that they have, no matter who they are, how much money they have, where they come from, there is a sense of history and a legacy of being done wrong to, which is real, and you can document it, and that's what those Confederate, you know, statues were all about. So the inflamed passions, are in the larger context of Trump, you know, killing civility, which enabled us, civility enabled us to kind of have these conversations, but not go off the, you know, off the rails on it, you know, and now we're just all screaming at each other.
It's gotten worse than that because I noticed in watching the video footage of the candlelight vigil for the trans woman in St. Louis, that a lot of the protesters, they were in the area, as I said, it's called the Grove, which is more or less the gay borough or the Castro or the WeHo, if you will. You know, there's flags, rainbow flags on a lot of the bars and buildings, and these are young people of, you know, color, obviously queer, and they are screaming, okay, at you know, the people in the cafes and stuff, and some of the vitriol was aimed, and they're screaming at gay people, okay?
Yes.
And they're saying, you know, you're white privilege, and you're this, and you're racist policies, and, you know, it's almost as if they're holding, you know, the white gay people accountable for the, you know.
And that's true, and that's what's happening in Los Angeles right now. I'm looking at a Facebook post where this trans woman of color has posted, "I haven't had a chance to address Nazis yet because I've been too busy fighting off gay white men with unchecked privilege."
Yeah, there you go. And I heard a lot of that yesterday coming from St. Louis. And, you know, this has become, it's becoming a very clear issue that we're starting to see more and more of, particularly also generational. Now, I'm talking millennials down, but, you know, I got a little bit of it, you know, quite frankly, a couple of them actually disrespected me. I was called an alleged reporter, and I fired back with, well, I guess after 40 years of being a political journalist, I guess I am kind of alleged. And then, of course, they Googled me and realized that, you know, oh, gee, he really is a reporter. Yeah, I really am a reporter. But you know, their first line of defense is I'm an old gay white guy, so I've got to be reeking of privilege. It didn't matter that I'm a trans ally. It didn't matter that, you know, I happen to be an ally for, you know, Latino and black communities. All they saw with their narrow focus was that. And unfortunately, in the larger sense, as you just pointed out, it's happening in Los Angeles. Rob, you and I talked about it happening up in your neck of the woods. And it's starting to happen more and more and more. There's a huge protest this weekend in San Francisco at Chrissy Field, which is near Golden Gate Park, or the bridge, rather. I'm sorry, not the park, the bridge, the Golden Gate itself. And it's already become polarized. I am seeing Facebook events and comments being made that reflect this, what I call balkanization, and instead of people coming together and really working with each other, I'm seeing a lot of vitriol. And this is an event where you've got several queer organizations wanting to protest these, you know, white supremacist, Nazi, whatever you want to call them, at Chrissy Field, and yet it's like, well, if you don't pass the queer, you know, radical purity test, then you can't protest with us. And that's going on in St. Louis. You, Karen, you've got it going on in L.A. Rob, you've got it going in Santa Cruz. It's going to happen this weekend in San Francisco.
Right. And I have to say, Brody, one thing in my experience is, and we obviously are seeing a lot of young queer people that are holding those attitudes, but I'm finding a lot that I've experienced personally has been more from the gender studies education system, oftentimes older generation people, maybe new to activism, young to activism, and not having lived through a lot of the years of the gay experience. But you know, I've experienced it more from people who are older than I have personally from millennials. But the thing that frustrates me is this vision of white gay male, like the white male is like the, pardon the expression, the trump card of the person, where most of the white gay men I know of a certain generation have been through the fire of the AIDS epidemic, which was not a minor one, which was not a privileged position at all, and fought up through those issues. And that is being erased completely in this discussion from them.
Well, and the young queer people of color in particular aren't really aiming at that generation. They're aiming at people between the ages of 35 and 54. So they're, and if you look at, I guess that's the Generation X or whatever, but that generation right there, okay, apparently, you know, there's a lot of friction there, particularly with the generation that's immediately right behind them, you know, the millennials.
Right.
And so there seems to be some serious friction there. I mean, I've seen some instances where there's been battling of folks our age, you know, and we're in our late 50s and early 60s. And yeah, there's some of that. And of course, we are the generation of the pandemic, and we are the generation where, you know, we couldn't be gay, we'd get arrested, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Guys, we're actually down to our very last minute. So, sorry, I just want to give you a heads up. So when the show ends, that's why it wasn't anything you said. So anyway, I don't think we're going to get much further on this, but I do want to thank you both for coming on. Obviously, we barely scratched the surface of this. So I want to put it on our thinking caps, and maybe next show we get together and talk about how do we resolve this? How do we bring our own internal camps together, because we're seeing a friction that is going in the wrong direction. Again, thank you, Brody. Thank you, Karen, for coming on.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Also listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com, Saturday night, 7 p.m. this Saturday, we will be going LGBT ghost hunting. And as fanciful as that may sound, there's actually some really cool historical perspective that we hope to gain from that as well. So you are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will be back again next Thursday, 7 p.m., same bat time, same bat channel. Thank you so much to my expert guests, and thank you for listening, and we will see you then.